This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Hey, thanks for joining us for what I expect to be a top-notch episode of the TriDot Podcast. It's always a privilege to sit down and learn from a Hall of Famer in our sport, and that is what we have the chance to do today. TriDot founder and CEO Jeff Buwer, in particular, expressed to me how extra excited he is for this episode of the podcast. Today, we are joined by Olympian and Hall of Famer Barb Lindquist. Of her 134 pro career starts, she won 33 races. That's 25%, 1 in 4 times that she started a race she won. She stood on the podium 86 times, and she had 114 top 10 finishes. That's 85% of the time she raced, she was in the top 10. Absolutely astounding. Her career covered all distances from sprint to Ironman, and she specialized in the Olympic distance, where she was the number one ranked athlete in the world for 2 years in a row, 2003 and 2004. She represented Team USA in the 2004 Olympics in Athens, placing 9th overall. And in 2010, she was inducted into the USAT Hall of Fame, and in 2017, into the ITU Hall of Fame. She developed and led USAT's collegiate recruitment program over 10 years' time, stepping down from that role just 3 years ago. Barb, thanks so much for joining the TriDot Podcast for this episode.
I'm so excited to get to talk with you, Andrew.
Also joining us for this conversation is pro triathlete and coach Elizabeth James. Elizabeth is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who quickly rose through the triathlon ranks using TriDot, from a beginner to top age grouper to a professional triathlete. She's a Kona and Boston Marathon qualifier who has coached triathletes with TriDot since 2014. Elizabeth, how are you doing today?
I am doing really well, and I'm also super excited for this episode. So yeah, let's kick it off.
Let's kick it off indeed. I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation, and then wind things down with our cool down. Before we get too deep into the show today, I want to give a shout out to our good friends at UCAN. Here at TriDot, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. In the crowded field of nutrition companies, what separates UCAN from the pack is the science behind Live Steady, the key ingredient in UCAN products. While most energy powders are filled with sugar or stimulants that cause a spike and crash, UCAN energy powders powered by Live Steady deliver a steady release of complex carbs to give you stable blood sugar and provide long-lasting energy. I personally fuel my workouts with the orange-flavored Edge Gel and the unflavored UCAN Energy. Between their energy mix, energy bars, almond butter, and more, there is definitely a Live Steady product that you will love. So head to their website, ucan.co, that is UCAN.co, and use the code TRIDOT to save 20% on your entire order. It used to be 10%, but the fine folks at UCAN have upped it to 20% off for TriDot Nation. So once again, that's ucan.co, promo code TriDot.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Whether it's your profession or your primary hobby, triathlon can be a very consuming endeavor. We all know how much time we spend doing the training, thinking about the training, window shopping for the things we need for the training, all in an effort to support our multi-sport as our primary obsession or hobby. For our warm-up question today, we turn aside from multi-sport to ask this: what is a hobby you have outside of your passion for triathlon? Pro triathlete Elizabeth James, what is another hobby you have that is not triathlon related?
This is a great question. And I was trying to think of like, man, as many episodes as we've done and as many stories as I've shared about myself and, you know, Charles and I, what we've done, I don't think we've talked a lot about things that are hobbies outside of the sport.
Yeah, and, right.
I mean, like you said, it's a very time consuming endeavor. And so I think this is a hobby that I'm going to share here that I haven't done much in the past couple years, but it's always been something I love. Definitely will get back to it someday. And it is charcoal drawings. And
really?
Yes. I absolutely love to draw. I took a number of art classes, even in college. If I, you know, had the extra time and kind of an extra opportunity, if I had a couple more credits that I could use, I actually spent those credits on taking some art classes because I just enjoyed it so much. So,
oh wow.
Actually, in our house, we have a couple of my charcoal drawings. I mean, I even have one up in our guest bathroom from high school of some different roses and flowers. And I mean, we've got some different landscapes. I used to do that all the time as like family gifts. I mean, my father-in-law had this picture of like some boats in the New England area. And so I sketched those and drew those out for him on Christmas. So yeah, charcoal drawings. I don't know if anybody would have seen that one coming, but that's why these are kind of fun. So we'll throw that out there as my hobby outside of triathlon that someday I will get back into.
Yeah, I had no idea, Elizabeth, that would be your answer. And what's funny, before we started recording, Barb, you asked me that. You asked Elizabeth and I, as well as we know each other now and as many podcast episodes as we've done, you know, would I know what her answer would be? And I thought, Elizabeth, maybe you would go, you know, the golf direction, because I know Charles loves to golf and you've done that with him before. I know there's some other stuff in your sports background with soccer and pure running. And I didn't know if you might say something about that or something about rooting for Nebraska college football teams. I didn't know. I had no idea that charcoal drawing was a passion of yours and a hobby of yours. And I'm excited, Elizabeth, when we throw this question out to our audience, to hear what our athletes have to say, because our athletes are going to have answers that,
yes,
as well as we know some of our tryout ambassadors, we may not know things like that about them. So super fascinating. Thanks for opening up about that, Elizabeth. Next time I'm at your house, I'm going to, yes, be on the hunt for your charcoal drawings.
I'll have to show you
on the walls. Uh-huh. Yeah. Coach Barb, what is this answer for you?
Wow. Well, I really respect people who are creative because I don't, yeah, necessarily have that in me. So I'm going to take this opportunity, because I'm your guest, I'm going to give two answers, because I live in Wyoming and we kind of have two different worlds here, the winter world and then the rest of the world. So in the summer, where we're just almost starting, although it snowed a couple times last week, my hobby would be golf. So about 8 years ago, we stuck our kids, who are now 15, our twin boys, in a first tee program at the golf course a couple miles down the road. And so Lauren and I said, well, we might as well hit a bucket of balls with his grandfather's clubs while they're in that. And then the next year we upgraded to his parents' 20-year-old clubs. And then I stuck with those for another year and he got some new ones. But that's maybe where I get my or where I let my competitive outlet shine now. So I've been in women's league for a couple of years, and and in the winter we'll take a week to go down to St. George, and I've never brought a bike down there. I've never swum in a pool down there or in a lake, but
you bring your clubs.
We golf, yes, in a row, and then come back to the snow. So that's my first answer. And the second would be that I love to read. And for the last 3 years, I've been homeschooling my boys. And so I've always loved to read. I love historical fiction, but the homeschooling curriculum that we use, it's not online stuff. It's all books based. So I'm learning along with them and reading along with them. And I love that we can be lifelong students, not just students of the sport, but students of history, or, you know, relearning something about science, or I'm learning Spanish this year when I took Latin in school. So yeah, all that.
Oh, I love the mindset of just being a lifelong learner in that way, right? You're never too old to learn, never too old to crack open a book and discover a new world or a different faction of history you weren't familiar with before. I'm a Kindle guy. I really like digesting my books on Kindle. And the book that I'm reading right now correlates with my secondary hobby on the side of triathlon. I'm reading a book called The Power of Pawns, because my secondary hobby is playing chess. I really enjoy playing chess. So when I was a kid, actually, in elementary school and middle school, our school district had a chess league. And so I was ranked. Every month there was a tournament. You play against other kids from other schools. I was the top player, not to brag, but top player at my elementary school growing up. And so it was just a childhood passion of mine. My grandfather taught me how to play at a young age. And as you get into high school and college, you kind of, you know, move on from those kinds of things. And when the Queen's Gambit TV show came out, I watched that on Netflix, and it kind of just revived that interest of mine again. And so I downloaded the chess app on my phone, and it's really cool because you can play people from all over the world. You can go in there and start a game and, you know, make a couple moves each day. And so at any given moment, I might be playing a game of chess with somebody from Australia and somebody from India. And I wake up first thing in the morning and they've made a move while I was asleep. And what's really cool for me is my sister-in-law. So my wife's sister, she's been dating a guy that she met at Baylor University, and he started playing chess around the same time I did. And it works out that we are about the same ability level. So in chess, you have an ELO rating. So our ELO rating is within about 50 or 60 points of each other. So we're very good. We're a good match. But that has become my secondary hobby. It's a great way to kind of pass the time. Again, like I said, very curious to hear what our audience is going to say here, because we're going to find out all sorts of things about y'all's personalities that we never knew. We know we're all triathletes. We know we're all obsessed with this sport. But I know there's some other obsessions in your lives that you're about to unpack for us. So make sure you are a part of the I Am Tryout Facebook group every single Monday when the new show comes out. We post this question to you, the warm-up question, asking you, and today it is, what is a hobby you have outside of triathlon? Can't wait to hear what you guys have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Ketones are nature's superfuel, and the team here at Tryout has been learning from Oxford University professor Kieran Clark, founder and CEO of T Delta S Global, about the benefits of drinking the revolutionary Oxford Ketone Ester. My new favorite way to start the day is with a ketone-boosted cup of coffee. It is a must on those days where I need to be dialed in for anything from a triathlon training session to podcast recordings. The team at Delta G created the Delta Gold Coffee Booster after research showed just how well ketones and caffeine work together. Delta Gold Coffee Booster truly empowers you to start your day like there's some extra watts firing to your brain. The team at Delta G even offers free 15-minute one-on-one consultations where you can learn more about fueling your workouts or just starting your day with Delta Gold Coffee Booster. You can book a call quick and easy at DeltaGKetones.com. So head to their website, DeltaGKetones.com, to book your free 15-minute consultation. When you place an order, use code TRYDOT20 to get 20% off your Superfuel ketone drinks. It's always an honor to hear from and learn from someone with as great of an impact on triathlon as Barb Lindquist. Today, we'll hear stories from her storied career, get a sneak peek into the development of modern-day Olympians, and hear some triathlon wisdom from Coach Barb that we can apply to our own swimming, biking, and running. So Barb, before you ever touched a triathlon, you swam collegially at Stanford University, you spent time with Team USA swimming, and then you made the transition to triathlon. Now back then, there wasn't a college recruitment program like there is today. So what led you to become a triathlete, and what was that transition like from Stanford swimmer to triathlete?
Well, it was a very slow transition because I turned pro at 26.
Oh, wow.
So I finished up my swimming career at Stanford, graduated, and that summer I actually had qualified for my second Pan American Games, which was in Cuba. So this is 1991. So I went and swam the 200 free, 400 free, and 4x200 relay. And when I got out of the pool in my last event, which was the 400 free, it was a race that I should have won, but I got second to another American, and I didn't swim it the way that I should have. I swam it conservatively when I should have gone out hard. And the reason I swam it conservatively was because I was afraid of what it would look like to go out hard and have somebody pass me at the end. And just that looks like you're dying, right?
Sure.
And so So I was swimming out of the fear of failure towards the end of my swimming career. So I got out of the pool and went to the corner of the natatorium, and I cried because I knew that I was done as an elite athlete or as a high level athlete. In fact, I'd qualified for Olympic trials in 92, which was 6 months later. But I said to myself, why do I want to swim for six more months to compete in the most competitive meet that there is? It's more competitive than the Olympics, US Olympic trials, when I don't like to compete anymore. It's not fun. I love to swim. I still loved to swim at that point, but I said to myself, why do I want to do that? So my mom had said, well, I grew up in Casper, Wyoming. And when I was 10, they built a second home in Jackson, Wyoming. And so my mom had said, Barb, you swam hard all these years. You studied hard all these years. Why don't you move to Jackson, wait tables at night, ski all day, and live in the vacation house for a year while you're trying to figure out what the next step is?
That's a nice offer. That's a nice proposition there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it definitely didn't take the Stanford degree to figure out that was the deal of the century. So a year turned into two, and they started to raise the rent to get me to spread my wings and fly.
Okay.
But Jackson at that time didn't have an indoor pool. But a year later, they had built an indoor pool. So I started to coach the club that was just a summer program, coach it into a year-round program. And then we started a high school program. So I started coaching. And then in that time, a friend was doing a triathlon. So I'm like, when I moved to Jackson, I bought a road bike because there's all these great open roads to ride. I ran track in high school. I was actually the Wyoming state champion in the 2 mile.
Oh, I know.
That's not saying too much. All off of swimming training. Like I ran for 2 weeks after my spring nationals. and then, so I'm running 16 miles on the trails in Grand Teton National Park before I go in for my my waiting tables at night. And so I'm like, I can do this thing. So I did well in this triathlon. And I think once you do well in something, you want to continue. Fast forward like 2 years and I, on a cycling club ride, like most places we had a Tuesday night ride and this guy, Lauren comes and rides up beside me. And I knew who he was because the town is small enough. You kind of know who the athletes are. And he had dated my running partner a couple of years prior. So we go on these runs and I'd hear about this guy, Lauren. Anyway, he comes riding up and he says, do you race? And of course, I say, yeah, I race triathlon, and roadies don't have much respect for triathletes.
Sure.
So, but he wanted to continue the conversation. He said, I think your seat's a little too high. And later I said, what were you doing looking at my seat? So he offered to.
It's a great question.
It is. Yeah. So he offered to give me a bike fit a couple days later. So I went over to his house. He gave a bike fit. He made me dinner. He played the guitar. And then on my way home that night, there was a full moon out. And so I called him when I got home and said, hey, you got to look outside because the moon is beautiful. By the way, I'm going to Vernal, Utah this weekend to do a triathlon. Do you want to come down and be my support crew? So he says yes. And we drive down there and I do the race and I place fourth, meaning three guys beat me. I beat them all out of the water. And Lauren, as a cyclist, was out there on the course. And he said two of the guys were actually drafting and cheating. So really only one guy beat me. And he had asked if I'd ever thought of turning pro. And that April I had done St. Anthony's as an age grouper. And I had placed, my time would have placed 13th in the pros. So it kind of had that as a reference. But anyway, we, talk all the way home. And he said he saw that weekend this potential for me to be his wife. And he saw this potential for me to be a pro triathlete. I teasingly say, I hope it was in that order. but eight weeks later, he proposed. So this is the fall of 95. And then in April of 96, we were married. And on our honeymoon, we did our first two pro races. I did St. Anthony's and St. Croix. And so, Team Lindquist was born. And he likes to say that not many people can have their honeymoon as a tax deduction.
Sure. I think for all the single athletes listening out there, just make mental notes that a successful pickup line is, hey, your seat's a little too high. Can I give you a free bike fit? That was a great way to spark a relationship there, apparently. That nice little cyclist flirtation.
But they also have to have those other skills of, you know, guitar, cooking. They can't just
as questions.
Yeah. I mean, there was a whole evening there. So
yes.
So once you were a pro triathlete, you know, you specialized in the Olympic distance, which to me is kind of a nice foreshadowing to your career specializing in developing Olympic hopefuls. So in such a competitive era of ITU racing, what was it like coming up through those ranks and having such success at that distance?
Yeah, well, it was much different than an athlete coming in now. First off, Lauren was my coach and manager, so he was kind of the brains behind the operation, and I was the brawn. It took a while for my swimmer's body physique to kind of morph into a runner's physique. And even at the end of my career, I was more of a strength runner, not one of these lithe runners that are out there. But, you know, definitely at the beginning, I was known as a swimmer and then as a swimmer cyclist, and eventually kind of got that full package where the run came around. And as far as USAT support goes, my first world championships I made in 96 was in Cleveland. And I for sure got a swimming suit. I for sure got a USA swimming suit, maybe a T-shirt, but there was no team hotel. We had no team meeting. I don't remember meeting any of the other people on the team beforehand. The qualification race for that Worlds, the Worlds was draft legal, but the qualification race was a non-drafting race.
Okay.
And
wow.
So it was like very, very new. You know, you're going to races without any support. Towards the end of my career, you know, when it became an Olympic sport, you know, you'd have a coach that would come to, or a team manager that would come to a race, and a bike mechanic for some of the bigger ones. And, you know, there was definitely more support. You stayed as a team, you talked about strategy, those sorts of things. And now when an athlete comes in, you know, it's even grown, you know, what USAT can do to provide for them. So it's really been fun to watch over the last 20, 25 years, just how great the support is for athletes coming in.
Yeah. And again, at the Olympic distance, we said it in your intro. I mean, you were the number one ranked athlete in the world in 2003 and 2004. And your strategy, from what I've read, your race strategy, you liked leading out from the front. Is that kind of because of what you learned in the Pan American Games in your swim career? Is that just because did it kind of fall naturally that way because you were a strong swimmer? How did that kind of become your race strategy to try to lead from the front and then stay there?
Yeah, well, definitely with draft legal, you have to play the cards that are given you. And I'm going to come out in the, you know, in the front pack or lead it out. So we could turn, you know, points in my career, definitely we could turn a 20-second lead out of the swim into 3 minutes. So wow. There'd be a couple Australians, you know, and then later a couple Americans who would get out of the water. We would work together like we were a cycling team. And we would take turns and be vocal, and we'd talk ahead of the races. And our goal was 3 minutes. That was like our goal. And we would see each lap, you know, oh, we're turned 20. Okay, now it's 30. Oh, now it's like 45. Now it's 70. We're going to crack them. They're going to, because at some point they're going to give up in the back and they know they're going to be racing. So we just knew if we kept on it, they were going to crack and give up. And then, you know, you get out on the run and it's every man for himself. So that's the way most races turn out. But there's one race where, well, there's more than one race where that didn't turn out. But there was one race. It's actually my favorite race that I did in Ishigaki. And it was in the early 2000s. And I had spent all winter in Australia and had won this, won the Australian series, and was going from Australia up to Ishigaki, Japan in April. I was fit. I was ready. You know, this, I've raced there before. I love Japan. This was my race to win. So we get out. My little swimmer group gets out of the swim, and we start working together on the bike. And our bike group it starts to disintegrate. People start falling off. I found out later, one girl found out she was just pregnant. Another one has been coming off of illness. But the big chase pack came up and caught the group. So I don't know what lap it is. Let's say 2 or 3 out of 8 laps. And I'm in this big group going, kind of having a little bit of a pity party. Oh, man, this was my race to win. What happened to those guys? Come on, now I'm here with everybody. And it took about half a lap of that. And then this is what goes to like working on your mental skills. because it's like one of my affirmations, I rise to the challenges that are set around me. And then I said, you know what? I have never got off the bike fresh to run. I've always worked hard on the bike with my group. We are working hard. I've never got off.
Okay.
The bike. So yeah. I'm in the group. We're rotating through, you know, it is an easy bike. So we get out on the run and Laura Bennett goes out like a banshee. And I'm just kind of running with some other people and my group kind of starts to fall apart. And then we start to reel in Laura. And then I've got the world duathlon champion, Michelle Dillon, in that group. I mean, there's some really, really great runners and they start popping off and And with 1K to go, it's just myself and this little Italian girl who's 20 and I'm 30 something. And I've only won a sprint finish once in my life. And that was against Joanna Zeiger. And she told me later she had an asthma attack. So I know I'm not going to leave this to the end. So with 1K to go, I say, I'm going to go now to myself
and see what happens.
Yeah. So I explain it that it's kind of like taking a step off a cliff and God put his hand under me and carried me the rest of the way onto a win. And I won a runner's race. It was,
wow.
It was just, yeah, one of my favorites because I wasn't I wasn't called a runner. Even though one of my affirmations was, I'm a runner, I'm a runner. And I'd say that over and over again in to the rhythm of my stride on a 10K.
Well, and how many athletes listening to this who identify with that and say, oh, maybe I'm a cyclist, maybe I'm a swimmer, but I'm not a runner. I just kind of hang on for dear life at the end of a triathlon. You know, so you would tell yourself that I'm a runner. And you would believe that and it would start to sink in. So I want people to catch that if that's you and you don't identify as a runner, you're in this sport, you are a runner, and start telling yourself that because that positive affirmation will pay off at some point on a race course.
Gosh, that's so cool. I mean, we've talked before on the podcast about those affirmations and so just to hear from you as well that, you know, that's part of what was your mental game as you were racing is so huge. And I feel like that's something a lot of people are going to be able to connect with. So just, it gave me goosebumps hearing you talk through the whole race and the excitement of it. I'm on the edge of my seat as we're just even here recording, what's going to happen? So again, that's so cool. Another race that I would love for us to just kind of dive in and get your perspective on is the Lifetime Tri Equalizer. And as Andrew and I were kind of preparing for, you know, this interview and prepping for it, we had never heard of this event until we were, you know, doing a little research, but wow, so cool. And if I may just take a moment and give a little backstory and kind of connection here. This Equalizer event caught my attention for a number of reasons. Now, there is a St. Patrick's Day running event that my husband and I did every year while we were living in Nebraska, and it was called the Leprechaun Chase. And it's a 10K race, and it has kind of this gender-based race to the finish line. And so the race kicks off with the women in the first wave, and then it's followed by the men 5.5 minutes later. And so, I mean, my husband and I would, you know, do our kind of head-to-head race because I would get to be in the first wave. And then 5.5 minutes later, he'd be chasing me down. And I mean, we traded on and off with who got to the finish line first. So it was a kind of big deal for our household each spring with who was going to win that event. And so, I mean, for the men and the women, whoever wins is the person that crosses the finish line first, and they get bragging rights for their gender. You know, they get the cash prize, whether it's a man or a woman. And then they get, I mean, since it's a St. Patrick's Day event, it's free green beer for either the men or the women, depending on who won. But like the Lifetime Tri Equalizer, is done in kind of that similar format. And so the inaugural year for that event was 2002. And the race put the pro women against the pro men in kind of that same idea of this equalized format, where the women would start 9 minutes and 30 seconds before the men would. And then the first athlete to cross the finish line took kind of that battle of the sexes style crown and was the ultimate winner. And Barb, that was you. I mean, you won that event. So I'd just love to, you know, dive into that story too a little bit more. Tell us, what was that event like?
Well, yeah, first of all, a couple really cool things. One, I should have named one of my children Lifetime because they were just so generous and they really wanted, their commitment to the sport was amazing. And it was, $50,000 prize for the first person was unprecedented. So obviously it was a key race for the season. Two things that happened in the pro meeting the night before. The first one, when they announced, they didn't tell us what our head start was going to be. They had this like timing clock that you'd see at the end of a track meet or something. And they started it maybe at 15 minutes. And they just worked it backwards until they stopped at the time. And the way they came up with our head start is that they had some numbers, geeky number people, who looked at world records for 1500 for women and men in the pool and 40K bikes and 10K runs. They did that. And then they looked at the triathlon scene now with times. And so they plugged all these numbers into a computer, and that's where they came up with the time. And the distance for that race was just a little bit shorter than an Olympic distance. So it was, yeah, it's just kind of a little bit of an odd distance just because of the way the course was. So we didn't really, I didn't really know, was that a good amount of time or wasn't it?
Yeah.
You just can't go hard on race day, right? That's out of your control. Okay. You just got to go for it. So, and the second thing they said in the briefing was at the finish line, there's going to be, gates on the side that you're going to run through, and there'll be a balloon arch at the start of the gate, but that's not, or the start of the chute. That's not the timing mat. The timing mat's a little bit further. So I'm like, okay, yeah, got that. Check. That's in the back of the brain.
Don't stop at the balloon.
Yes, yeah, don't got stop it. At the balloon. Yeah. So we got on the swim, and I actually did not feel very good on the swim. I think I remember saying to myself, whoa, this is going to be a long day. But I got out on the bike and it felt good. So again, another thing to remember is that triathlon, especially longer races and even Olympic distance, you don't have to feel good in all three. You can feel bad in one and still rock out the next ones. So yeah, had a great bike. Was kind of going back and forth, I think, with Becky Gibbs Lavelle, who's from that area. And then we're out on the run, and I'm in the lead, and we're coming into the finish last quarter mile. And I know that Becky is behind me and that Craig Walton from Australia is behind her. And it's all pretty close. So I go into the chute, and what do? I'm sprinting, because I know, if Craig is anywhere near, he's a guy, he's going to be sprinting faster than me. So I better boogie on. So I get to the balloons, and what do, Andrew?
You stop.
I stop. I slam on the brake, stop. And they're yelling, no, 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 go.
Keep
and when
going.
You really did a full sprint and you stop, and then you have to get going again, knowing that people are behind you, it was like rigor mortis. It was not the prettiest thing. So when you see the pictures of the finish of that, I am my eyes are bugged out, and I am reaching for the tape, and I fall over the line because I don't know how much time I have lost in this little balloon debacle. Yeah. So
but you still won, but you still got it done.
I still won. Yeah. Yes. And they gave me a big check. I got the big check like a fancy.
Yeah.
And when I went back home and, to the guys I swim with, I was almost a little embarrassed to say how much I won.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of money. But then
I think the overall prize purse was 200K for the whole field. And so your winning of that was the 50K, which it's public information. Everybody knows you just won 50K from this race.
That's right. And I swim with a lawyer and a real estate agent, a CPA, and I started doing the math hourly for a year. And yeah, they're still making more money than I am. Yeah. But the next year it was $250,000. I'm not sure if you saw that in your research.
And you won that year as well.
I won that year as well. And it was me and then eight guys and then the next woman. So it's not like it was, they got the equalizer time. They did really well both years, right? Because Craig was 15 seconds behind me the first year. And then the next year it was me and then all these guys and then the next woman. So it's not 10 women in the top 10 and they messed up.
No, absolutely. And what it reminds me of is, it's funny that you refer to the math, data geeks were the ones that set that number, crunch a bunch of numbers. And Elizabeth, it reminds me of how now with remote racing, when Predictive Fitness puts on remote races, you finish the race, you get your time, you get your time equalized to the race course, but then you can also press the equalizer button and it equalizes for age and gender. And so I remember the first remote race I did, it was the inaugural USAT inaugural remote racing national championships last year. And I think overall I was 10th or 14th or whatever And once I hit the equalizer, it was not kind to me as a 33-year-old male, because I had all these older athletes and some female athletes past me, because when you account for age and gender, their performance was superior to mine across the board. But just like you said, Barb, it's the data geeks and the software engineers at TriDot are the ones that are crunching the numbers and have the algorithms that dictate, okay, whose performance was better between a 33-year-old male and a 63-year-old female who ended up doing better than me in the equalized standings. It's a fascinating thing in sports to examine. And I always love seeing it with remote racing. Anytime there's a new remote race, even when I don't participate, I always go look at the standings and look at them pre-equalize and then equalize them and then look at them to see who moved and who wasn't in the top 10 that is now in the top 10 and vice versa. Because it's really cool. And so it's really cool to see that back in the day, they used to do that as a professional field race. And I wonder how many people would watch it. I mean, Elizabeth, I can imagine as a pro, I mean, would you want to participate in a modern day equalizer race with a pro field?
I think that'd be fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I loved the leprechaun chase that Charles and I did. And so I'm like, man, they had that in triathlon format. Like, let's bring this back.
So Barb, earlier in your swim career, you were a part of Team USA Swimming. You talked about competing at the Pan American Games, but you never competed at the Olympics as a Olympic swimmer. So fast forward to the Athens Games of 2004. Triathlon became an Olympic sport. So the Athens Games of 2004 was the second time that triathlon was in the Olympics. What did it mean to you to get to represent the United States at the Athens Games as a triathlete?
Yeah, well, I think like many of your athletes, I bleed red, white, and blue. In fact, you know, now when we go to sporting events for my kids and here we have the American flag always and the national anthem, I still get teared up and chills. And I think back to all the times I've seen the American flag raised for me around the world on the podium. So I just love our country. And it was just such an honor to get to represent, like, wear the USA on my chest. But kind of backing up, it was in the Olympics for the first time in 2000, and I was ranked third in the world and had been the top American for a couple of years and didn't get to go to the big show. It was actually a blessing in 2000. And if you'll indulge me, can I tell you a reason why I can say that?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So when I didn't make the Olympic team in 2000, it was kind of like two odd races. One, I crashed on the bike in this on the test event in Athens, actually crashed twice on the bike and still came out in the front pack on the run. Felt amazing. I mean, felt so good. I just said to myself, you know, no heroes, Barb, you just have to be the top American across the line. And at about 7.5K, I start to say to myself, whoo, I'm starting to lose focus here. And kind of bring it back, Barb. And I think by maybe 9K, somebody passed me. And then by the end, I did like a stumble, fall across the line. And I think what happened is that, you know, when you crash, your adrenaline goes straight up. And which is why I felt so good going out on the run. And I was running conservative, but at some point it has to come down. And that's what I think happened in that. And, you know, to crash twice with a pretty good dent in the helmet. Yeah, all that stuff. So the next race was in Dallas at the end of May. You guys know what the temperature's like there right now.
Yeah, sure do.
Yeah. So I'd struggled with some heat races before. And Sheila, Tarmina, and myself came out of the water and we had a 3.5 minute lead going into the run. And you just had to be the top two Americans there. And so I just said to myself, no heroes, Barb. You know, it's hot out here. And it was a four loop course. And by the end of the third lap, I can feel that I'm losing control of my legs, that they're kind of hitting each other. And a couple people passed me. And it's the first race I, at that point, ever pulled out because I'd had heat stroke before and I was going down this path.
Yeah.
So kind of like two really odd races where I feel like if God would have wanted me, he could have changed adrenaline. He could have, you know, I feel like I was the best athlete at that time and I didn't get to go. And that's just the way sport is. So that's 2000. So continue on racing. And I had my best years of racing in 2002, 2003, 2004, including those races we talked about, lifetime, like best races financially. One of those years I won 13 of 17 races.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then get to go to the Olympics in 2004. But I think I really believe that if I would have made a team in 2000, that I think some of my edge would have been off. Like I would have felt, especially after being to Olympic trials for swimming and age 31 and my husband's a little older. Like I think, I don't know if I would have continued on racing much past that, that wow. my edge would have been off. So I don't know if I would have had those financial years, those great financial years. And the reason I mention that is that when I retired and in November, we got pregnant in April with twins. Those years of racing were those years and what we made financially allowed me to be a stay-at-home mom, allowed me to like choose to work as much as I wanted to. I mean, I worked for USAT, it was part-time and I got to do it except for traveling for camps and races, like all from home. And so I was able to be there for my kids. And you can tell the kids that where their parents are there, and you can tell where they're the parents or the kids where the parents weren't really there. So if you would have asked me as an athlete in 2000, hey, you get a choice. You get to make an Olympic team or you can stay at home with your kids that maybe you'll have someday. Like I would have chosen an Olympic team in a second.
Sure. Yeah.
So I don't know if that all makes sense to you, but you know, in thinking past, you know, you have time to retrospect when your career's all over. And I just really think that God had a bigger picture for me, and I'm going to tear up with it, but like a bigger picture for us than me getting to race in Sydney. And I mean, I loved Australia. I spent 8 winters there. I just knew that course, loved it. I mean, I was probably a better athlete then than I was in Athens, but there's more important things than that. And God knows.
Goodness. You're going to make me tear up too. Like I mean, thank you for sharing that with, you know, us here on the recording and our audience. I mean, as we sit here, I don't know if you could see on my shirt, but I've got the God is greater than the highs and lows. And that's a big thing for me. And so, I mean, that's something that I've just always tried to keep in perspective too, of like sport is great. And wow, the opportunities that we have are fantastic. And there are so many exciting things and there are some lows with it, but just keeping that eternal perspective is cool. I mean, it almost makes me lose my words and I'm fumbling over them now because it's just like, it's just awesome to hear. So kind of, I mean, to shift us here back, I guess, into the collegiate recruitment program a little bit and maybe another plan that, you know, he had in kind of your journey here. I mean, that race in Athens was kind of your beginning of the impact on like Team USA Triathlon. I mean, from there you started and developed the collegiate recruitment program that USA Triathlon uses to identify Olympic triathletes. So take us back a little bit, you know, on that part of the journey. What's kind of the origin story for the recruitment program and your involvement in that?
Yeah, well, when I had talked with our high performance director at USAT at the time when I was racing with Libby Burrell, and we had been talking towards, you know, my last year of racing, which was the year after the Olympics. I raced one more year in 2005 about, you know, I wanted to work, you know, help out and give back. And so they created this role called the Elite Development Coach. So I mentored coaches and worked with some of the elites that were coming up through the pipeline. A couple of years past that, the new high performance director, his name was Scott Schnitzbaum. When you're part of a big corporation, I don't think you have this at TriDot, maybe not. You have to write up goals for the year. Have you guys ever had to do that before? Goals for the year. So I wrote, one of my goals was if somebody wanted to methodically recruit collegiate runners and swimmers, how would you go about doing it? So I wrote up this little plan, these steps of how you'd go and recruit people like myself to be Olympians. Well, Scott said, how would you like to make that your job? And so I'm like, yeah, cool. So it was all from the start. So you have to figure out, well, what type of athlete do we recruit? Like, what are our time standards? How fast of a runner do they have to be? When they're a swimmer, how fast of a runner do they have to be? When they're a runner, like, you know how it is to teach adults how to swim. There has to be some sort of swim background. Yeah. And I'm sure there's lots of athletes out there. Yeah. Oh, you're one of those, Elizabeth.
I might be one of those. I'm hiding my face here now.
You can't swim yet when they're young. And then how do we get the word out about this program? So I had to develop relationships with NC2A coaches, and I went to NC2A championships and had a booth and gave out information. And then once we identify athletes, what do we do with them? What do we do with them? And so for a while, I found local coaches, maybe like yourselves, where I would set them up with the athlete, so the athlete could stay where they were. And then I would mentor the coach and the athlete as they're kind of coming up through the ranks. And then eventually we started a resident program at the Olympic Training Center, so we could take those best athletes and stick them with a coach and have them fully supported. So Gwen, for example, was of the group. Gwen Jorgensen, she had, you know, stayed in Wisconsin and had a local coach, Cindy Bannock, who, brought her along through the first Olympics. Katie, we also, at the very start, she had a local coach, but then she was in the first class that came to the Olympic Training Center and got to train there for a while. And now there's squads out there, you know, that there's international squads where athletes can go to, but that was kind of the origins of it. And this last Olympics that we had in Tokyo, we had three collegiate recruits on the team, Summer, Katie, and Morgan. And the other two athletes came through our junior program, that Steve Kelly, he was kind of my parallel compatriot with that, developed the junior athletes. And after Tokyo, we got a lovely email from Rocky, the CEO at USAT, to myself and Steve and Andy Schmitz, who was the high performance director after Scott, and then Bobby McGee, running guru. And he said something like, Rocky said something like, "This was your Olympic team," because we had the CRP and the juniors, and Bobby had worked with both of them, and Andy had been, you know, amazing overseeing with it. Rocky's a super classy guy, and I'm just so happy with his leadership there. But, with the CRP, having both Scott and Andy were excellent. They were my boss because they were a high performance director, but I mean, they never made me feel like an underling by any means. Sure. They were, you know, let me run with it, but they were there to bounce off ideas, and they were big picture and had great ideas themselves, because the program had to completely morph over all those years from the very beginning, and from our time standards to everything. It always had to evolve, just like the sport of triathlon evolves.
That's really cool to hear. I mean, just, you know, how that all kind of comes together and the different pieces of it. I know that, you know, our TriDot founder and CEO, Jeff Boer, speaks very positively about his time working with you in Colorado Springs. I mean, coaching Olympic hopefuls and that top 12 program alongside with you and Bobby McGee. As we're kind of talking about that, it made Andrew and I wonder, you know, what do you remember about, you know, coaching alongside our dot father here, Jeff? I mean, any funny stories that you can share with us about our boss? Anything you would like to, you know, put out there from your times together?
Dot father, that's hilarious. I love that. Jeff was one of the local coaches that I talked about that I set up with an athlete who was a runner, and he was living in Dallas. So that, I think, was the first time that I met Jeff, was through that relationship of getting to mentor him. Although, you know, he had plenty of goods to bring to the table with coaching this athlete. But that's when the first time I really got to know him as a person and just see how he cared for the athlete too. So, and our paths have crossed many times since, and sometimes it's just small conversations and sometimes conversations that have nothing to do with triathlon, but he's a man of God and he has integrity, and you can see when he's talking to you that he cares about you. Just the way he looks at you with the eyes, he cares about you as a person first, and then whatever the purpose of the conversation, that's kind of secondary. So, yeah, you guys are very blessed to have him. I don't have any funny stories that I can think of. I'm so sorry about
that. If you think of one, just email Elizabeth and I separately. We'll make sure that it gets told on the podcast. Yeah. I trust in the middle of the night, one of these days you'll wake up and be like, oh, I've got one.
You know, as much as he knows about triathlon, he's also got that business acumen. And it's kind of like you, Elizabeth, when you've got this like creative side. I really respect people whose wheelhouse is not anywhere near mine on things like that.
Yeah.
So, I respect that he loves triathlon and knows so much about it, but has a business model to be able to share that knowledge and family and all the positive things that triathlon has with other people.
So Jeff was actually there at the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs when you were inducted into the US AT Hall of Fame. In the same ceremony, it was you, Mark Allen, and Hunter Kemper being honored as the Hall of Famers there. Amongst just all of your other career accomplishments, what does that particular honor mean to you?
Yeah, those were two legends to be inducted in. Now that I'm on the Hall of Fame committee and get to look at the resumes of the people who are in our sport, I mean, we have some amazing people, not who have just done things, incredible accomplishments on the field of play, but they have given so much back to the sport. Like the quality of people, of triathletes out there is very deep. So it was a real honor to get to share that. I mean, I felt like I was sharing that honor with Lauren because we are Team Lindquist and I couldn't have been there without him, nor would I have wanted to. So I hope that he felt honored on that night too. Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
So you had success, like we said, at all distances in your pro career, but a specialty of yours was the Olympic distance. It's a popular distance for our audience. It's so challenging, but it's so fun to race an Olympic. What should our mindset be towing the line at an Olympic rather than some of the other distances?
Yeah. So I did a half. I did Wildflower back in the early 2000s and I won.
Nice.
In 2000, when I didn't make the Olympic team, I got a nice letter, like in the mail letter from Lou Freeman, who was the head of WTC at the time. And he said, I'm so sorry you didn't make the Olympic team. Would you like to come race Hawaii this year? So that would not happen now, right? Because the pros have all this point system to get there. Yeah. But I went and raced Hawaii. I trained Olympic distance all year and then just increased my long run and long ride. In fact, I won LA Triathlon 3 weeks before that. And that was a $20,000 prize purse, which I think was more, it might have been more than third place at Hawaii that year.
Wow.
But anyway, but I love Olympic distance because you get to race it. You get to push yourself to the red line, whereas those longer races, it's the distance that pushes you to the red line. And for most people, you're kind of holding back all day long in one of the longer races. I mean, you've got your exceptions, pros and stuff like that. But but I love just getting to be aggressive and, it's short enough that you can race more than a couple a year for sure. And you can learn from each one and you can, I tell my athletes, you don't know where the red line is unless you go over it. And I went over it a few times in my racing and had some heat stroke and like stuff like that.
But some learning opportunities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you never know until you go over it. So because, Olympic distance is so short, you can recover from it and race again in another 2 or 3 weeks. I could say the same thing about the sprint now. That is just a fun distance for sure.
So foundation of your coaching philosophy is that you should fit triathlon into your life, not your life into triathlon. Now in an arena where balance is often sacrificed at kind of the altar of achievement, I was just going to ask if you were able to follow that balance kind of yourself while competing.
Yeah, I actually, like one of my prayers to God was if this sport ever takes over number one in my life, because it should be God, my husband, and triathlon, like in that order. I said, like, whack me upside the head to make sure that it does. And I think because Lauren was, we did everything together. He was my coach manager. He traveled around, it was something. Yeah. And we didn't have kids. like it was easy to not push him aside. And then, you know, really triathlon was the second chance at sport. It was, I really feel like God had his hand on the sport with me. So it was, I don't want to say it was easy to keep in the forefront, but I always knew that this was his mission field and I was kind of along for the ride.
Gosh, that's awesome. That's, I am very fortunate to be in a women's Bible study each Monday evening, and all of us are athletes. And that's kind of, you know, something that we make sure that we are calling each other out on and making sure that, you know, our priorities are in line. And
yeah, I love that. It's great.
It's neat. This kind of really goes into the last thing that I was going to ask you about. And we've touched on it a number of times here today. I mean, the number one core value for TriDot as a company is that we are founded in faith and focused on eternity. And I mean, I've shared on the podcast before and kind of brought it back up again today that that's something that I care very deeply about in my own racing journey. That, you know, we've talked about how sport is great, triathlon is great, but none of that matters if we don't keep our faith first and then really translate that into how we're working with others. So making sure that our athletes know that they matter deeply to us as people first and then as athletes second. And I know that that's, you know, a core value, Barb, that you would get behind. We've talked about that today. And you've been, I mean, such an important influence to so many athletes, both in the sport of triathlon, but also an important influence beyond sport. I mean, talk about mom coach. There's, you know, some things that you've been able to really pass along to your athletes. So, I mean, just to kind of wrap things up here, I'd love just to ask you this, you know, what do you believe? What has been the impact that your faith has had on your career and your coaching?
Well, I feel really blessed to have had really two athletic careers and both as a Christian. So I was a Christian as a swimmer, but it wasn't the same. You know, we're all at different growth spots on our walk. It wasn't the same as when I was a triathlete. So when I was in college, my sophomore year, we won NCAAs at Stanford. My junior year, Janet Evans came into Stanford and she was a distance swimmer. And my coach, Richard Quick, who was at the University of Texas before he came to Stanford, Olympic team coach, thought that every distance swimmer should swim as much as Janet did. So for the first time ever in my career, I got overtrained. And I was afraid to go into Richard's office and tell him that I was feeling overtrained because I thought that would be a sign of weakness. And I kind of put him up on a pedestal, like that he was a god because of his coaching resume. So I finally got enough courage to go in to talk to him 3 weeks before NCAAs and said, you know, Richard, you're burying me. But that still was not enough time to come out of that hole, that downward spiral of overtraining. And when we got to NCAAs, I had a horrible meet and I scored 3 points for my team. Whereas the year before I had finaled in two events and consoled in another, and we got second to the University of Texas that year by 9 points. And that was like out of like 300 or 400 points. And not that I felt from anybody else this responsibility, but I took that on myself that was my fault. And so my senior year, I went in racing, as I mentioned at the very beginning, about the fear of failure. And I didn't race with joy. I got on the blocks and just said, well, what happens if I die in this event? What will my parents think and my coaches think and my teammates think? And it really just sapped the joy out of competing. Fast forward to, you know, Jackson and like that time of waiting tables and just kind of, yeah, putting on weight and just kind of enjoying life. I did a Bible study in our church, and that Bible study was all about getting your identity in Christ, which is Christianity 101, not on our performance, but on Jesus's performance at the cross. And that was a freedom to me. And God used that to give me back to the desire to compete again. And I would never, never have thought that could happen. And so triathlon really from the beginning was this second chance to do sport right. It was like a gift from him. And so I really wanted to honor God with that. And so I knew that he could use losses as much as he could use wins for his glory. So, you know, I had some parents after I didn't make the team in 2000, you know, I got letters in the mail, again, old school letters in the mail, like saying, you know, how you reacted to the, to your disappointment has been an inspiration to my kids. And, so, you know, I just feel like that, yeah, God was able to use that. And then when I retired, I thought, well, that's done. God's done using me in trial in this platform. Like, how short-sighted was that of me? Of
yeah.
How great God is. And so, yeah, to get to share the stories with my own kids who are now, you know, competing in different sports, and share them with my athletes and, yeah, other people. My faith, it was a key part of all of that racing. And, you know, I have athletes now who are believers that I've done Bible studies with, and some that aren't, but I am open and real and I hope relatable to them so that they can, be open and real to me and we can have a relationship, because I mean, that's what coaching is about. But that's relationship is what, God wants also with us and for us to reach out to other people.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Like I say every single show during our warm-up, every Monday when the show comes out, we throw our warm-up question out to you, our audience, on our Facebook channel, the I Am Trot Facebook group. And it's always fun for me to see the responses roll in. And it's funny because week to week, you know, just depending on the question, sometimes we get a few dozen responses to that question. Sometimes we get hundreds of responses to that question. And it's always interesting to me just to see which questions you guys think are interesting to kick around and which ones get a lower response. And sometimes it surprises me which ones get just a ton of responses and which ones don't. And this one that I'm going to talk about here on our cooldown today, it was from episode 139 of the podcast. We had the warm-up question: what is something in your life that you have compared triathlon to? And we got a ton of really, really, really interesting responses here. Some things that seem kind of obvious, some things that I wouldn't have thought of, that you guys thought to compare triathlon to. And so I'm going to close the show today by just reading a few of our favorites. Straight off the bat, Andrea Winters said a colonoscopy. She's comparing triathlon to a colonoscopy because without a healthy approach to training, crap happens. Really meaningful response here for our next one. This is from Cheryl Roper. She said, I've dealt with depression and suicidal thoughts for years. When you're feeling super tired in the middle of a race, making it all the way to the end can feel overwhelming and impossible. But I can always swim one more stroke, pedal one more time around, run one more step, and eventually I reach the finish line and it's incredible. Sometimes living out my whole life feels overwhelming and impossible, but I can always take one more breath and just sit one more minute, no matter how painful it is. I haven't reached life's finish line yet, thankfully, but eventually the darkness and pain lift, and I'm so grateful to still be here. Cheryl, incredible response. We're all grateful that you're here as well. Can't wait to cheer you on at your next race, and a very interesting take on something to compare triathlon to. Jessica Qualls is comparing triathlon to a puppy. She said, it sounds like a great idea, and you are excited picking the perfect one, but the actual training of both is a bunch of hard work and can get messy. But looking back, you forgot how awful it was and think about doing it again. Dave Bianco said that triathlon is like planting a vegetable garden. You spend a lot of time planting, watering, and weeding, and you spend a lot of money on the soil, tools, gloves, fencing, hoses. For one day, once you pick them and eat them, and you're done. Carrie Burt, Triathlon Ambassador, she said, not triathlon per se, but I started calling rare things at work unicorns. I'm not sure if any of my coworkers get it or not, but still. Carrie, I absolutely love that. They probably don't get it, but we here, your Trot family, we get it. We're for it. We had multiple people answer some form of childbirth or pregnancy. Lori Oaks said she's comparing triathlon to getting my two kids to multiple sports practices while running a business. Transition is the car with snacks. Love that. Thong Wing Yu said my wallet, because when one goes up, the other goes down. So he's kind of pointing out an inverse relationship between the amount of money in his wallet to the amount of triathlon toys that he has. Kevin Coleman Jr. said that he is comparing triathlon to working as a teacher. August through mid-November is swimming in the first half of the bike. Thanksgiving break is like the bike special needs bag. Christmas break is the transition area. Spring break is the run special needs bag. And the last week of school is that red carpet. And all of the teachers out there said amen and hallelujah. Emily Tromp, she said, my wedding day. I followed the phrase, nothing new on race day. I made sure I had the trial appointments. I had to pack a day bag with anything I could need, including a change of shoes, like a transition bag. I made sure to hydrate and eat throughout the day, had a good pre-wedding meal, was prepared for the unexpected. I made sure to smile and soak it all in. Also got the best medal at the end. April compared being a triathlete to joining the military, saying that both required to have integrity, perseverance, discipline, dedication, and grit. April, thanks so much for your service. I believe we're Facebook friends, and I believe you are training for Ironman Alaska. So keep the training going. Good luck in that endeavor. Rooting for you. We had a couple folks compare triathlon to being an entrepreneur. Allison Chisnell and Galen Nuttall, both are those. I'm sure Tronaut founder Jeff Boer, who is a triathlete and an entrepreneur himself, would agree with you. Desiree Patton, she said an infomercial, because wait, there's more. And last but not least, Flaquita Campos, I love this one from her. She says that triathlon, it really compares to nothing. I love it and hate it all at the same time. Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank Olympian Barb Lindquist and pro triathlete Elizabeth James for joining us today. Huge thanks to Delta G for partnering with us on today's episode. To learn more about the performance-boosting benefits of Delta G ketones, head to deltagketones.com and use code TRIDOT20 for 20% off your order. Don't forget, you can book a free 15-minute video consultation with their team to learn more about how you can get the most out of your ketone drinks. Also, a big thanks to UCAN for being a longtime partner of the podcast. At TRIDOT, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. To experience UCAN's Live Steady products for yourself, head to their website, UCAN.co. Use the code TRIDOT to save 20% on your entire order. We'll have a new show coming your way soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TRIDOT podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great TRI content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TRIDOT.com and start your free trial today. TRIDOT, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.